This week on Behind the Lens.
Don't shoot! You're good.
The city of New Orleans braces for yet more protests over police brutality and the killing of George Floyd. We'll have coverage from the demonstrations, including accounts from two Lens reporters and a medical volunteer, all tear-gassed on the Crescent City connection. What would you do if you were exposed to tear gas? We'll have some first aid tips. The Reverend Gregory Manning joins the discussion on the long way forward to a resolution. And we'll examine how the protests are impacting some favorite New Orleans institutions. I'm Tom Wright. You're listening to Behind the Lens, brought to you by community support. Learn more at thelensnola.org/donate. Welcome to our listeners on our partner radio stations, 90.3 FM, WAMFLP, and 102.3 FM, WHIVLP, New Orleans. Journalist at The Lens began the week noting the relative lack of violence between demonstrators and police here in New Orleans, but a fragile peace seemed to crumble Wednesday night, at least temporarily. That's when George Floyd protesters marched on the Crescent City connection spanning the Mississippi River. Police blocked the progress across and launched at least two tear gas canisters at the crowd of hundreds and hundreds of protesters. But by Thursday, it appeared unlikely that the demonstrators were put off by the show of force the previous night. That's the sound of marchers heading out from Duncan Plaza Thursday on a winding march through the city on the way to NOPD headquarters and the courts at Tulane and Broad. Several advocacy groups have joined together to organize these demonstrations. Take 'em Down NOLA organizer Angela Kinlaw was one of the speakers at Thursday's rally. She explained the stakes to attendees and the city at large.
Where there is no justice, there will be no peace. So if you're concerned about peace, if you're concerned about your buildings, but you're not concerned about our lives, there will be no peace. For us, in our black bodies, you've already disturbed our peace. So now that our peace is disturbed, your peace will be disturbed.
Black Lives Matter is far from the only refrain at these rallies. Kinlaw and other organizers are addressing workers' issues, too, including conditions faced by frontline workers amid the COVID-19 emergency.
There's not one more taco and water party that they need to throw for the essential workers. There's not one more free pizza they need to deliver to the nurses who've given up their lives to heal people right here. When you won't even convert the plants to make the ventilators that they need to do the job that they need to do. You gotta be kidding me. A taco and water party for the essential workers. How about some living wages, hazard pay, PTO, and PPE? Are we not clear? So when we say flip the budget, that's what we mean!
Michael Isaacstein and Charles Maldonado have been covering the protest for The Lens. They spoke with me Friday.
Thursday kind of went off without a hitch. It was the first night in three nights that the demonstrations didn't end with a face-off with the NOPD. Compared to especially Wednesday night, things went pretty smoothly. The march went all the way uptown, up Washington to Toledano, and then to the courthouse on the corner of Broad and Tulane, where there was a discussion, and then the organizers were able to successfully kind of tell everyone to safely go home in groups, and that's what happened next.
Certainly a dramatic departure from what happened Wednesday. Charles, I want to ask you to pick it up here. Tell me what happened Wednesday from your perspective on the bridge.
Wednesday began, as most of these protests have, there was a rally in Duncan Plaza with several speakers talking about police violence, particularly against black people. Affordable housing and a range of other issues. That was followed by a march that went through the Central Business District, then up St. Charles into the Lower Garden District, and then turned back around, headed back towards the Central Business District, eventually making their way up an on-ramp to the Crescent City Connection approach. Police had been escorting the march throughout the evening, staying about a block or two ahead of it. When they got onto the approach, there was a large police blockade made up of officers in riot gear, attempting to keep the protesters from crossing the bridge onto the west to the West Bank. The night before, Wednesday and Tuesday, there had been a similar standoff, or there had been a standoff with police that ended very calmly with protesters eventually agreeing to go to leave Interstate 10. Wednesday turned out quite a bit differently. Protesters were up, approached the police. There was about an hour long back and forth between protest organizers and police officers. At one point, and I was not aware of this until later, the police handed over a microphone to one of the protesters who warned that if they continued to try to push across the bridge, that they would be met with resistance from the police. Unfortunately, no one was able to hear this, really. I was at the very front of the line of protesters right up against the police throughout most of this, and I couldn't make out a word that was being said, and I did not hear any warnings from the police officers themselves. At about 10:15, a very small group of protesters, apparently from video I saw subsequently, tried to push their way through the police blockade, at which point tear gas was fired off into the crowd, which was mostly made up of people who had nothing to do with this brief scuffle with the police officers. That was most of the evening.
We saw a little bit of video. We certainly heard several reports of some of the protest organizers and the group itself shouting out before the tear gas was shot, black men, white men up front, women in the back. As if to prepare for a physical confrontation with the police.
That seemed to be interpreted differently between the police and the protesters. What I've heard subsequently from protesters was that they were doing that because they were anticipating police. They were anticipating a heavy pushback from police. The police seem to have taken that as a threat that the protesters were intending to commit some sort of violence. That happened just a few seconds before the tear gas and the brief scuffle between a small group of protesters and police. Right before that had happened, I had moved from the very front of the protest to about maybe 30 feet back from it, because I was right up against the ledge of the overpass, and I was a little worried, you know, what could happen if things started to get ugly there. And I could from that vantage point, I was not able to actually see with my own eyes what was going on at the very front. I was only maybe a few rows back from it, and I couldn't see anything. There were so many people there.
Gotcha. Michael, you were also on the bridge that night. Got a little bit of video of what happened.
Where I was probably maybe 100 feet back, maybe 100 to 200 feet back from the front. So from my perspective, when the tear gas was shot off, I mean, we really didn't know anything that was going on. The discussion where I was, oh, okay, it looks like it's going to be the same thing as last night. They're not going to let us through, and we're just all going to go home. And so that's what everyone was talking about. And suddenly we just hear this crack and then see the smoke coming up. And I'd say for the next, 10 to 20 seconds, there was a real panic that struck into the crowd. People started pushing. People started running. And the demonstrators kind of had to work together to tell everyone to calm down, to slow down, to not stampede, to not run anyone over. And the crowd was able to quickly organize and slow down and make it a little more safe. I'll say, you know, from a personal perspective, it was pretty scary. I haven't been scared in that type of way in a long time. I know from my perspective that the night before that had felt completely safe. There were medics around. There were people providing water and food. Going back to this idea of preparing for a physical confrontation, that's something I've been thinking about a lot as a justification to use force on protesters, because it goes back to the idea of these protesters were approaching, you know, they had this big armored vehicle, you have riot police. So the question is, if you're preparing for, well, was it the protesters who prepared for a confrontation first, or was it the police that presented them with, you know, the situation where a confrontation would occur? They talked about the danger and risk of allowing the protest to go forward. If I had one question for Superintendent Ferguson, it would be whether they measured that risk against the risk of shooting tear gas into a skinny overpass filled with people.
Organizers themselves claimed between 5,000 and 7,000 people took part in that Wednesday night protest. I don't know that that number has been confirmed in any way by the police. The Thursday protest seemed larger to me from what I could see, at least at the kickoff rally at Duncan Plaza.
I have the same questions as Michael about the wisdom of the police action on Wednesday night. From my perspective near the front of this, there were, and again, I had moved back because I was so close to the edge of this overpass, which is high up of the city. It has a very low ledge. There was certainly a danger of people falling off if there was a panic, and there was a brief panic, as Michael described. I was caught up in the stampede, it was pretty scary trying to get down away from that, there was a danger of people being trampled. There were children in the march, it was a very scary situation.
I think the convert, you know, again, one of the justifications given by the NOPD for why they used the tear gas is that the crowd was preparing for a confrontation. The conversation I heard on Wednesday when everyone was walking out, once the confrontation had kind of stopped and people were walking back home, the discussion was among protesters, hey, we really were not prepared for that. We were not ready for how we would react when tear gas was shot at us. And I think what concerns me now is that what I saw on Thursday night was definitely more preparation for confrontation. I saw plywood shields. I saw way more helmets. There just seemed, again, from Wednesday to Thursday, the preparation for a real confrontation with the police was higher. And if that is being used by the NOPD as a justification to start use of force on protesters, that definitely makes me a little concerned.
Charles, what are you going to be watching this weekend?
Well, we at the Lens are going to be paying a lot of attention to what goes on Friday night. There's a protest at Jackson Square tonight. A big point of contention between a lot of people who are involved in this protest and the city of New Orleans, meaning the statue of Andrew Jackson in Jackson Square. Notably, these protests have been organized in part by Taking Down NOLA, which was the group that was very involved over the years, leading the charge to take down various Confederate era monuments or Confederate monuments around the city. some, you know, many of which were taken down several years ago. This group has also, you know, demanded that the Andrew Jackson statue be taken down as well. It's a symbolically important location for many of these protesters. And on top of which, now that we've seen active confrontation with the police, this situation seems pretty tense right now.
Michael, all this activity out there on the streets has certainly not been lost on members of the city council.
No, there was a reaction certainly at the Thursday meeting. So the council had put out a resolution on their agenda earlier in the week, basically condemning the killing of George Floyd, supporting the demonstrations, the peaceful demonstration against systematic racism and police brutality. But the resolution also had a paragraph in it basically commending the NOPD for being partners with the community rather than opposing them during these protests. But that was quickly changed after Wednesday night once the tear gas was shot into the crowd. So we saw a few changes once Thursday came around. So they took out that paragraph and added a paragraph urging the police to act peacefully towards protesters. And there was discussions of some other social action too. Jay Banks brought up he said he would be going after an ordinance to ban the use of tear gas in Orleans Parish. Council member Helena Moreno said she wanted to get the process started for renaming Jefferson Davis Parkway, named after the one and only president of the Confederacy. And that has been a big goal of Taking Down NOLA. Taking Down NOLA, they worked to get those four major monuments taken down a few years back. But they've been working, you know, on a lot of smaller fights that haven't gotten as much attention, but to rename schools, to rename streets. And, you know, after Councilmember Moreno brought up the idea of Jefferson Davis Parkway, that kind of expanded into this broader conversation of, hey, well, we have a lot of streets named after white supremacists and a lot of New Orleanians that haven't been memorialized. So we might actually see that open up as the months go on. We'll have to watch that.
Both of you and the rest of the LEND staff will continue to monitor these nationwide and local protests against police brutality. Charles Maldonado, news editor, and Michael Isaac Stein, reporter for the LENDs. I thank you both.
Thanks, Tom.
Thank you.
At least five protesters were arrested Wednesday night, three of them New Orleanians. And while there were no serious injuries reported, the medical risks of using tear gas amid the COVID-19 pandemic are worrisome for medical professionals. Kara Corin is a medical student living in New Orleans, and she's been volunteering as a field medic with the protesters.
It feels really bad. I would not recommend. I had like almost every single protester that I saw, I had a mask on. I wear glasses. I had put on a flannel shirt over my tank top. I tied my hair back, told the person I was with to tie her hair back. And it's hard for me to know how far up I was, like how close I was to the actual police line, but we knew it was coming because we heard people screaming and saying, turn around and go back. But the situation, which had been so peaceful, became so chaotic. But just to speak to the physical feeling of tear gas, it was in my lungs. I was coughing. I felt like I couldn't breathe. I knew to stay calm and try to keep my breath calm to not make it worse, because I know panicking makes it worse. It was in my eyes. It was burning. I was able to close them. It was such a suddenly chaotic situation because there were so many people and we had nowhere to move backwards because of just the number of people and being trapped on a bridge. And people were doing a really good job of yelling, don't run, and holding each other up and try and move coordinated. I saw a person be passed by bleeding from the head, injured. I couldn't reach her, and we were just screaming medic, and the crowd did a really good job, even being tear gassed, even in a like potential stampede situation of making sure this person got pushed through faster to get medical care. But it was very chaotic and it was very scary, and it put a lot of people in danger.
Let's leave aside for this discussion the dire medical risks of being in the middle of a stampede of people.
Right.
That's bad enough. you told us what it feels like personally. From your experience and your training in medicine, I understand you're not a doctor, but tell me what you have learned about what tear gas and similar airborne irritants like this used in crowd control. Tell me what these do to the human body.
In like the cloud of the gas, it's called tear gas. It makes your eyes water profusely. It makes you cough. Basically, it gives you have a physical reaction to this chemical weapon being used against you. And to use it, you're purposefully, intentionally inducing someone to have a reaction that's going to create droplets, all kinds of droplets from your eyes. You're going to be coughing and temporarily incapacitated and in pain. And it'll mess up your vision and your ability to breathe. And it very purposefully increases the risk of COVID in the middle of a respiratory pandemic to induce coughing in a group of people that's close together is shameful. It knowingly puts people at risk who are advocating for a group of people who are already at higher risk for this disease because of the structural racism that exists in this country.
So certainly there has been a reaction from the medical community to these latest developments and this deployment of tear gas by NOPD. Tell me about that reaction. What are some of your associates doing to draw attention to what you perceive here as some very serious public safety risks in this use?
Yeah, so there's a group of people who I did not write the letter, but is circulating a letter from healthcare professionals in the New Orleans area expressing our great concern at the use of tear gas against protesters all the time, but especially in the midst of COVID-19, that what happened on Wednesday at least seriously injured one person and harmed our citizens indiscriminately. And just these healthcare providers have been voicing that we support protesters protesting safely and exercising their right to do so. We think that racism is a public health issue that is worth protesting for, but that we know there's increased risk in gathering during this time, and everyone has been wearing masks. I know there have been many people, us included, handing out face masks. Really, everyone's wearing masks, but using tear gas is directly against all public health measures of infection control, especially in the middle of COVID-19, because we know that it increases the risks. It irritates the respiratory tract. It increases inflammation. It induces coughing. It increases the number of droplets being dispersed in an environment where there were a lot of people, especially on Wednesday night, trapped in a space. And in the midst of this deadly pandemic that has disproportionately affected our Black community, the healthcare community.
Care community does not support the use of tear gas and is really upset that NOPD put people at risk like that.
And I will say, and just observationally, and it's not my job to lay blame, but I will say that when you are in a situation like that with several hundred people basically at a very linear bottleneck, and then to see tear gas hit that crowd, it strikes me as a super spreader event, as you know, we've been warned in other cases by medical professionals. Do the protesters themselves have a responsibility to protect themselves against just this sort of situation? A crowded space with not a lot of room, certainly not 6 feet distance between participants?
That's a tough question. I don't know that I have a good answer to that. I do think that what I've personally heard the speakers say every night is to do our best to maintain social distancing, stay close to the people you're already quarantined with, wear a mask, not to be touching other people, to stay home if you're not feeling well, I've read things about getting tested within days of being at a protest just to see if you could be asymptomatic. And I think that this is like my personal opinion, not speaking on behalf of anyone else. We have to weigh the risks. And I personally feel, and I'm someone who lives alone, I'm young and healthy, I have access to healthcare, which are all privileges that I know not everyone has. I'm not, my med school stuff doesn't restart until next week. So I feel like I weighed the costs and benefits, and like I feel like it's a risk worth taking, that this is a cause that I will put myself at some risk for, because I believe in it so much. And I think that what I've seen from the crowds, and I'm not someone who loves crowds, but I have seen, it's truly been breathtaking the way that I've seen the community of protesters taking care of one another. From, I can't even count how many people I've seen handing out water bottles, masks, other supplies, snacks, really showing. I felt safe in that crowd on Wednesday until I was tear gassed, and it was safe. And I think there has been a feeling of responsibility for one another at these protests. There is obviously an increased risk by gathering in crowds, but I have seen overwhelmingly people doing everything in their power to mitigate that risk, and show up anyways.
And Kara, I am in no way qualified to offer a pop quiz to a medical student, but I'm going to offer you a pop quiz as a medical student. No pressure. This is not this is not for academic credit. I get hit by tear gas at a protest. What do I need to do? What's the first aid?
So what I would say, and what I was trying to do, is don't panic. Try to keep your, if you have space to, which we didn't on Wednesday, your limbs out to let the wind take as much away from you as you can. And what we have been doing out there and encouraging others to do, I know people have a lot of like remedies and stuff, and the internet is full of suggestions, is just water, just flush it out, rinse it out. I recommend the like squirt bottle types of water bottles to just aim water better at the eyes, and to do it in a way that you're not going to pour tear gas water from one eye into another eye, but to try to go like from the center outward. Basically, if you're out there in a protest and you get tear gas, you just rinse it and try not to panic.
Kara Corin is a local medical student here in New Orleans. She has been serving as a field medic at the protests, and she's associated with a group of medical professionals signing a letter in protest to the tear gas usage by NOPD. Kara, I certainly hope you and yours will stay safe throughout these protests. And I thank you so much.
Thank you so much. I hope everyone stays safe as well.
You're listening to Behind the Lens, a podcast by The Lens. I'm Tom Wright, and we're broadcasting on our partner radio stations, 90.3 FM WAMFLP and 102.3 FM WHIV LP New Orleans. Pastor Gregory Manning of Broadmoor Community Church has been attending these rallies. He's a veteran advocate and campaigner and co-moderator with the group Justice and Beyond. I spoke with Pastor Manning earlier this week about what's going on here and across our troubled nation.
You know, when I hear about all that's going on throughout the country that is very violent and turbulent, we've not seen the violence break out and destruction that we've seen in other cities. I am just so proud of the city of New Orleans that we are really just setting an example and being a model of what peaceful, effective protesting looks like. But I think it also demonstrates the willingness to listen, you know, and I think that's what's needed so much right now, is to say for NOPD or any law enforcement officers to say, and many people on different levels to say, we hear you, we see you, we hear you, we're paying attention, and we're seeking to understand, and not always to be understood, but to understand and to say, we hear what you're saying. I mean, they could have gone up on that I-10 and the police just could have refused to listen, but they listened. They listened, and that's what's going to take, is people being willing to be open-minded, sit at the table together, and to say, we got open ears, we're ready to listen.
This is not a movement that's about to stop, given what I see, what I'm hearing from participants and organizers. This is not just about one man's death, is it?
Absolutely. Absolutely. It is absolutely not. You know, we have to recognize that the reason why, you know, we need to, first of all, be very grateful in this day and age that we have so many people that are willing and know the importance of pulling out cell phones and getting video. And so we're very grateful that now is the time that we have been availed with this technology that is there. And so, you know, this is, but all the time that technology and that availability to get someone on the cell phone is not always there. It certainly is, you know, with George Floyd, as it is with Ahmaud Arbery. But it's not always there. And so there are many, many incidents all the time that are not caught on film. And so we need to stand and say that we recognize this is, you know, and get folks to understand, especially white people, that this is happening all the time, that there are these aggressions, and including very violent aggressions and very microaggressions that are happening every single day, all the time, that go unnoticed and get buried, and people are murdered and lynched and just violent of a way that George Floyd was murdered. And so we need to advocate for systemic change in order that the whole system and many systems that are interconnected would go through a complete overhaul and reformation.
Yeah, we've been here before. You know, we Alton Sterling in Baton Rouge, the 92 riots come to mind after the Rodney King acquittals. The track record is rough.
Yeah, and I was just going to say, and I think all of us, the people that I'm talking to, are saying, you know, we're trying to evaluate, and I'm sure you are thinking, is this moment different? You know, is this different from every other moment that we've experienced where people have been rioting and had public outcries? Is this really different? And I think we're trying, you know, many of us are feeling, well, yeah, it certainly feels different. And we're hoping that it's different, that we don't, it doesn't die down, and we just wait for the next one to happen. So I'm hopeful, Tom, that this is a different kind of moment, that this is a watershed moment that will be the catalyst for real change.
I've got a question at the tip of my tongue, Gregory, and I'm trying to finesse my way into it like a bull tiptoeing through a china shop.
I understand.
When some white people see this, what's going on TV, certainly if they're fixated on the more violent aspects of these disturbances across the country, Minneapolis, New York, Atlanta, Washington, etc. And a lot of white people react, the first emotion with which they react is fear. Yet we've seen on the streets with these huge peaceful protests across the country, a real coming together of people of different ethnic backgrounds, different lifestyles, different political philosophies even. It's one thing to talk about what the message is for Black Americans and other minority American citizens, but what do white Americans have a special responsibility to react, respond in a way that ultimately brings us closer together. And how do they find that way?
Yeah, that's an extremely good question. You know, my thought is this. First of all, I've been thinking a lot about liberation and the idea of liberation. And most often when we think about liberation in the context of these United States, we think about, of course, those who were enslaved and those who have been subjected to oppression, that they are the obvious candidates for liberation. But when we kind of draw back and look at the whole entire history of this country, I think we need to begin to understand that it is not just Black folks that need liberating. It is all people that need liberating, including white people. And white people would never consider themselves. I want to be clear that, you know, and maybe I'm misjudging or misdiagnosing it, but I feel that a lot of white folks would say, well, I don't need liberating. I'm free. And I think we need to look at liberation as differently. We have all been victims of being in bondage to this society that has been built in such a way that it's the survival of the fittest. It's driven by capitalism. It's driven by productivity. It's driven by I need to conquer you and I need to dominate you. I need to be in power over you. And so we all are just in bondage to that sort of thinking that leads to destruction, that leads to inequity and injustice and inequality. And so if we understand, look, I've got to free my mind and free my disposition and all of that I've been caught up in from all of that thinking and establish a new understanding, I need to be liberated. And so while we all need to be liberated, but yet in different ways, possibly, but we all need to go through some form of liberation. And I really believe that, as I said at a speech on Saturday, that millennials need to be liberated from this world that they've been left with. I believe there are many things that we need to ask millennials for forgiveness on. And one is, environmentally, this trashed world that we left them. Another is this very, very racially dominated world that is sickened by systemic institutional racism. And so I think right now it's the time for the millennials to stand up and say, I don't want this to be my legacy. I don't want this to be the world that I live in, that I raise my children in, that I'm trying to coexist in. I don't want this that you all have calls and has been called since the birth of this nation. And so I think they have a special responsibility because millennials are different. They're different from my generation, which is Gen X. And other generations, baby boomers, they are different. I've looked at them. I've observed them. They got a different spirit in them. And so I'm counting on them and believing in them to say, look, we're not going for that show. We're not feeding into that. We're not getting on that bus. We want something different. And so I think they are the ones that I placed upon them the mandate and the mantle to say, now it's time for you to call the disruption in your platforms and your arenas, whether that be at your dinner tables or Thanksgiving tables or your Christmas tables, to say, look, whatever it is, this racist talk and these racist mindsets that guided this family, I'm not going to tolerate it. And if it continues to persist, then I will continue to speak out and I won't allow myself to be a part of it. So I'm really counting on them to say, you see all this protest in the street, we're going to protest in our families too. And because it's their parents who are owning the businesses and have positions of power, I believe that they can, and I'm optimistic that they will speak to them.
The Reverend Gregory T. Manning, co-coordinator of Justice and Beyond and pastor of Broadmoor Community Church, New Orleans. Gregory, as always, it's a real pleasure.
Thank you, Tom. I appreciate it. Thanks for having me on today. God bless you.
Two iconic local organizations have found themselves in unwelcome focus amid the Black Lives Matter protests. Saints quarterback Drew Brees apologized not once but twice after his criticism of NFL players who protest during the national anthem. And a Carnival crew captain had to apologize after she posted All Lives Matter messaging on social media. A lot of members of the Mystic crew of Knicks are outraged by this. Some have announced their departure, but we spoke with one member, Amanda Hearn, who is determined to stay put.
I decided it's not just Julie Lee, it's not just Drew Brees. There needs to be representation. It's like a hangover from segregation. You don't live around Black people. You don't know what's really going on. You don't talk to anybody, and then you think you know. You don't. You need to be around people. You need to hear them, and you can't do that if they're not in your space. So I'm going to stay and be in everybody's space. I mean, Drew Brees and Julie Lee are like, oh, we didn't know. You're like choosing to ignore a galactic amount of empirical evidence. That's your choice. In this day and age, saying I didn't know or I was ignorant is a choice, and it's unacceptable. So now you got to do the work. I joined Crew of Knicks 4 years ago in 2016. My first ride was 2017, and it was one of the most amazing experiences of my life. Just absolutely indescribable how mystical and beautiful and fun and sisterhood and New Orleans and all the things. It's like one of the top things in my life that I've ever done, which is why I wanted to keep doing it.
Is that what appealed to you about Knicks? I mean, that the very word sisterhood stands out.
Honestly, that was just something that I discovered when I joined the crew. What appealed to me about joining Knicks was that it was not an all-white crew. Full stop. Mardi Gras is like a case study in institutionalized racism. Okay? Still to this day, all-white crews, rebrands of crews that refuse to integrate, so they stop marching, and then now all of a sudden we got crew with Drew and Morpheus and Detroit and whatever. Okay? Knicks was started by a woman who was a cop who decided that, for whatever her reasons were, she wanted Knicks to look like New Orleans.
That's Julie Lee.
Which means, yeah, Black women, white women. We have Asian women, differently abled women. I was a bartender and a server on a float with people who are doctors and lawyers and executive coaches and stay-at-home moms. It looked like New Orleans. I joined Knicks because I wanted people on the route to see a crew that reflected who we are as a city and not just who people are as a social strata. That's why I wanted to join. Because the first Knicks parade I went to, I was like, it's a lot of Black people for crew. Like, I wasn't expecting that.
Ms. Lee posted a social media image.
It was a stock footage of a Black child comforting a white child, hashtag All Lives Matter. That's what it was.
That's right.
Posted to the official Crew of Knicks Instagram. That's exactly what it was. And I found out because, ironically, a few days before this happened, I had tweeted, semi-annual reminder, Crew of Knicks is the most diverse crew in all of Mardi Gras. Okay, that happened about a week before she did this. And I woke up to the news because somebody quoted my tweet and said to me, they don't want you, sis. That's how I found out about it. And that's where it hit me in my heart. As other Black women seeing that and thinking about my crew, it's all a fraud. It's all a farce. They don't want you, sis. Like that, in a nutshell, is why it cut me. My core, why I Black Knicks sisters, and honestly, a ton of white Knicks sisters. There are entire loads, not just a few people, entire loads. Because you know, when you're in a crew, you're on the same float every year.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you don't just move around. You have a float lieutenant, and you're on there with the same people every year, so it's a little family. Whole float. there are 3,000 or 3,500 women in NICS. Okay. A whole float could be anywhere from like 90 to 110 people. We're devastated, betrayed, heartbroken. Okay. So I had to make the decision. Do I want to leave or do I want to stay and fight? If I ride, people are going to be angry and they're going to say things and they have every right to. I have to accept that and I have to be ready to take it.
Amanda Hearn, a proud New Orleans resident and member, a remaining member of the Mystic crew of NICS. Amanda, thank you so much. I really appreciate your time today.
Thank you, Tom. I really appreciate you giving me a forum to be heard.
That's all for now, but monitor the lens on Twitter and Facebook for live developments from Friday night's protest in Jackson Square. We'll bring you special reports by podcast this weekend on the protest, on the COVID-19 crisis, and on this tropical storm that seems to be brewing in the Gulf and heading our way over the weekend. Our reporting is always online at thelensnola.org. I'm Tom Wright. Thank you for getting behind the lens.